So good evening. This is Time is Ticking. This is CAGNY's environmental campaign. CAGNY is the umbrella group for Sussex, Surrey and Kent. It's an aviation and environment group. It's made up of volunteers. We mostly focus on Gatwick, but this time of year with COP27, we focus on the environmental impacts and ramifications of airport expansion. And I'm delighted tonight that we have got Tim Johnson from Aviation Environment Federation. Now, Tim joined us last year and his talk was really popular with everybody. And so tonight he's going to cover the impact of aviation has on the planet. But he sits in the hot seat with many government meetings and international conferences on aviation. So he's our good guy amongst a lot of those who basically are involved and work within aviation. We're not against anyone and we're not anti-aviation. This is about trying to work together to make aviation greener, but also to educate on the impact flying has on the planet. So I'm now going to hand over to Tim, remove myself, and let's put Tim in the hot seat. Tim, over to you, if you can unmute yourself, please, and I will mute myself.
Thank you very much, Sally, and good evening to all of you. It's great to be back. And to give, I think, an update really on what I sort of talked about last year. So I'm just going to enable this and then we're ready to go. Okay. So yeah, last year I spoke a little bit about aviation's impact on climate change. And you know, this is quite timely that here we are, COP27 in Egypt. And Sally sort of asked me really to sort of reflect on the last year, what's happened, what's changed. Are we in a better place than we were 12 months ago or not? And it has definitely been a busy year, both domestically and internationally. And I'll talk for about 25, 30 minutes, no more than that. And then it'll give us plenty of time for questions at the end and we can have a discussion. So if I move forward to, let me see, there we go. Just a little bit of brief introduction to AEF. So we're a national environmental NGO. We work on all aviation's impacts from noise right the way through to its climate impacts. We're based in London. We have an office close to London Bridge on Bermondsey Street. We're funded entirely by environmental and philanthropic organisations and foundations. I have to say it's easier for us to raise money for climate change projects for aviation than it is for noise, despite the fact that noise is probably the issue that affects our members most of all. And that brings me on to say that we are a membership organisation. That's the federation in our title. And I think, you know, we represent the communities that live under the UK's airports and the smaller airfields. It's not just about the Gatwicks and the Manchesters. It's about people who are affected by helicopter operations and those farmer sort of rotations of aircraft that go up with banner tows in the summer over beaches. Everything from the small scale to the top. And of course, live under flight paths as well. And we've been going since the 1970s. And the reason we were established is because groups like CAGNY and others, but back in the 70s, felt that they could get so far having a discussion with their local airport, but they really wanted an organisation that could campaign nationally and could talk to governments and really press for better environmental legislation to protect them from noise and emissions. And that's what we do, as Sally said. We do engage with government. We have a seat on its Jet Zero Council, and we have a seat on its Airspace Strategy Board, and also on things like the Airspace and Noise Engagement Group. But we also have an international focus. So way back, and this is quite pertinent to today's discussion, way back in the late 1990s, when the Kyoto Protocol, the first real global effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, when the Kyoto Protocol was put together, everyone sort of wondered, how should we allocate emissions from aviation to countries? Is it on the basis of departing flights from their airports? Should it be on the basis of the nationality of the airline? There was one proposal even that should be on the nationality of the passengers themselves. So you'd have to do a passport count and then allocate the emissions. And while that was going on, the opportunity to get the Kyoto Protocol agreed was running out. Time was running out. It was almost the last couple of days of the meeting. And so right at the last minute, the Kyoto Protocol went through, but international aviation and shipping emissions were left out. And international aviation, we were told, countries were told, pursue that through a different UN body, pursue that through the UN's International Civil Aviation Organization. And that's based in Montreal. And we went knocking on its door and said, we'd very much like to come in and be part of your proceedings. And we were told, well, you can. You know, we would actually welcome civil society voices, but all the airlines attend and get one seat, and they're represented by IATA. All the airports have one seat at the table, and that's the Airports Council International. And it's the same for manufacturers. So if we wanted to come in, we had to have a global voice for NGOs. And so we worked with organizations in North America and in Europe. And we came up with this organization called the International Coalition for Sustainable Aviation. Back in the 1990s, that sounded like an NGO. Today, it sounds like an industry coalition, but we've never really changed the name. The NGOs are the International Coalition for Sustainable Aviation, ICSA. And we attend UN meetings. We are able to put in working papers and to comment on the positions of states. And I'll say a little bit more about that. So that's us. We have a relatively small staff of about five or six people. And we try and cover all of this from noise to climate, from domestic policy to international policy, and at the same time, try and help members with their casework and their fights against airport expansion. So you've probably seen a lot of talk about the COP process and the climate talks at the moment in Egypt. You may be thinking, is there anything on the agenda that's going to affect aviation? And the short answer is no, but there probably should be. And the answer why it's no, I've just explained, and that's because the Kyoto Protocol left out international aviation emissions. But it didn't leave out domestic aviation emissions. And that's not a big deal in the UK. I mean, our domestic aviation emissions are only about 4% of our total aviation emissions. But you'll see from this slide, this is a slide by ICAO, which shows the split between international, which is in dark blue, and the sort of pink bar, which is domestic, in each of the regions. So if you take the third one along, which is Europe, you know, it's a similar story to the UK. 74% of all the traffic in Europe is flying internationally. And I say it's much smaller in the UK, it's more like 96. But it shows you that for us, only a small proportion of our aviation emissions would be in our climate commitments to the COP process. But it varies enormously. If you go to Latin America, if you go to Asia Pacific, if you go to North America, it's the complete reverse position. In America, 84% of their aviation emissions come from their domestic flights. And obviously you can think the big land masses, you know, for the Brazils, for China, for India, that explains why sort of, you know, the Latin America block is so high and the Asia Pacific block is so high. So really, for me, I think the climate talks that are going on now often represent a false position on aviation. They always say, oh, aviation's not part of this. You should go and talk to ICAO. But this slide says otherwise. This slide says for many countries and many regions, we should be talking about at least domestic aviation. And it's 40% of the total globally. So, you know, I would have hoped for more. Looking at the agenda, there's nothing formal on the agenda for aviation. There is a transport day, And there are lots of side events. It's a bit like party conferences. If anyone's been to a party conference, you know, you have the main conference from Labour or from Conservatives or from the Lib Dems. And then throughout the day, you have a series of fringe meetings organised by groups advocating for their position. And that's true of COP as well. So there's a big programme of aviation events going on around Transport Day. But by and large, the main agenda is not going to come up anything to do with aviation emissions. A general framing, yes, a sense of direction, but no real specific commitments. And I think that's a real shame. And I say, if anyone says to you, "Ah, oh, but that's because international aviation is not part of these talks," you can say, "Yes, that's true, but domestic aviation is, and it's still a huge part of the global problem." So I turn to my next slide. What's changed since last year? So this slide shows traffic levels around the world by month, starting in January 2020. So really just before the global COVID pandemic really took hold. Again, domestic aviation is in red, international aviation is in blue. And the green line that tracks across the top, that shows traffic levels in 2019. So you can see that for every year since the 2019 peak, we have not managed to return to those sort of levels of pre-COVID. We've got the very sharp sort of fall off in April 2020 when lockdown began and borders closed. And domestic traffic rebounded around the world very quickly because it was travel within borders. And so that's not really taken a hit. But you can see that international travel is still very low. And whilst it's creeping back up, it's probably going to be another year or 2 years before we hit pre-pandemic levels. Obviously, that was you know, an unintentional reduction in emissions. But equally, it's a fairly temporary state of affairs. If you look at where the industry is going, this is cumulative emissions of CO2 globally. And despite that hiccup in 2020 around the pandemic, you still see very strong growth all the way out to 2050. And it's very likely that all the pandemic has done is to slow down that rate of growth, rather than to stop it or make it change direction. In fact, the latest predictions are by 2050, we'll only be up to 10% lower in terms of growth and emissions than we would otherwise have been if COVID pandemic hadn't happened. So this is a really worrying chart from a climate perspective. Obviously, it shows that globally, the amount of fuel that the aviation industry will need will still increase by two or three times compared to where we were in 2019. And it also gives evidence of you know, what the UK is predicting for, sorry, what the government is predicting for UK airports. So many of you will have seen that the Jet Zero strategy still supports growth in the UK of a 70% increase in passenger numbers. And that's supposed to be over 2018 levels. So not 70% over today, but 70% over pre-pandemic levels. And 2018 and 2019 were record years. And so you could translate this curve and say, well, this is likely to be replicated in the UK. What's really interesting is although the government confidently predicts that passenger numbers will increase by 70%, it hasn't actually issued a new passenger forecast since 2017. And it says one of the reasons it hasn't is because of the uncertainty about energy prices, changing business travel behaviour. And given all of that uncertainty, it wants to wait until it gets a sense of what the long-term trends may be. But that doesn't seem to prevent them from supporting airport expansion and almost encouraging airport expansion, regardless of the fact that we don't really have that evidence base in place in terms of what will happen to demand. So this is a really complicated slide that you don't need to digest the detail of, but just a really important reminder that when we talk about aviation's climate impact, we're not just talking about carbon emissions. As important as carbon emissions are, you know, all the latest scientific advice tells us that the total climate warming impact that aviation has is a factor of 3 times higher than that from the carbon emissions alone. And that's because of things that happen as a result of a flight in the upper atmosphere, like the formation of contrails, the things that you see in the sky. They sort of have a sort of complicated role. You know, they can prevent ultraviolet reaching the Earth's surface, but at the same time, they trap radiation at night. Where they form persistent clouds, they stop the release of heat, and it leads to sort of localized global warming. And you can measure and predict all of this, and you find that it has an impact of 2 or 3 times more overall. This very colourful looking building is the UN's International Civil Aviation Organization in Montreal. One of the things that has happened in the last few months is that ICAO has held its assembly. Now, its assemblies aren't annual. The climate talks that you have at the moment take place every year. ICAO's assembly, when all its 193 states gather, and they talk about everything from navigation to security to environment issues, they only ever happen every 3 years. So they're a big event. And this was the outside of the ICAO building in late September, early October. And you've probably seen this headline: ICAO agreed a net zero by 2050 goal. Now, I have to say, ICAO gets a lot of criticisms, but I have to say that this was actually quite a positive thing if you look at it in a global context. There are lots of countries where the debate on climate is not as advanced as it is in the UK, and having a global goal helps to make them think about aviation, helps to make them start monitoring emissions and reporting emissions. And so we've brought more countries into the climate discussion. Getting the agreement itself was also very difficult. Normally, climate is the big thing that everyone falls out over. But this went through with a remarkable degree of consensus. There was a reason for that, and it doesn't have much to do with environment. And that is that I think states come to the assembly with the energy for one big fight, and normally it's around climate policy. This year with Ukraine, it was all about security, and a lot of accusations leveled at Russia for incursions into Ukraine airspace, which I know is not the major issue given the war, but it's a way that ICAO could bring pressure on Russia and show that the international community disapproved of its actions. And so in its own way, ICAO had a fight really with Russia. Russia was effectively voted off ICAO's council. It no longer has a seat on ICAO's council. Countries didn't want to vote for it. But we also had North Korea firing ballistic missiles over Japanese airspace during the meeting. And so these issues were really taking up countries' energy, and that left less energy and less time for the climate discussion. And it really meant that the countries that were a little bit unsure about this felt rather isolated. So no one wanted to be seen to side with Russia. At the same time, Brazil, which is China's biggest ally, or one of its biggest allies at the climate talks, Brazil had done a deal with the US. China felt very alone. It could see that the consensus in the room was to agree to this net zero goal. And at the end of the day, it didn't stand in ICAO's way. It has issued what's known as a reservation, where it says it fails to recognize the agreement. But it wanted to stress that it was very much behind the goal. The goal was an important thing to set. And so it's good that we have this consensus. Critics will pull it apart, and you may have seen things in the media that do pull it apart for several reasons. One is it says it's aspirational, so it's not binding. But then UN bodies can't bind states. They don't have legal authority. You know, states effectively legislate to give weight to ICAO standards for noise or navigation procedures. That's the way you get states to adopt and make them legally binding. But, you know, it was aspirational, but it was also set at a sectoral level. It was applying a goal to the industry as a whole and not to specific countries. And that was really important for the smaller countries. They didn't know whether they could get to net zero by 2050 without financial help and support. And so having a goal that was a sector-wide one and not something that applied to them in each and every country was part of that political unlock. So I would argue that for once ICAO has done a good and a positive thing. Hopefully it allows the UK to be bolder, because whilst the industry always says, you know, you shouldn't be setting rules at a national level, you should set them internationally so there's one standard, one harmonized approach. Equally, I think ICAO has provided the UK with the cover to set rules, because the UK can now say, well, our rules may differ from Europe or from North America, but everyone's on the same journey. Everyone's committed to doing the same thing. So in one way or another, everyone's industry is going to have to adopt something, and that's going to come with cost. And we're not sticking out our necks as much as we would have done if ICAO hadn't reached this agreement. So that's one way of looking at this as a really positive outcome. The other big thing that happened this year was the government's launch in the UK of the Jet Zero strategy. So this was following on from Boris Johnson's Jet Zero Council, which he established a couple of years ago. The Jet Zero Council was all about getting a zero emission flight across the Atlantic within a couple of generations. Within a generation. Whereas the Jet Zero strategy is more about how do you get the UK aviation sector down to net zero. And this came out to sort of great fanfare in July of this year. And I really want to focus on this, because it really requires sort of closer scrutiny. On one hand, there are some positives that we can take from it. First of all, we've set ourselves a target. So we have that same 2050 net zero goal. We have a 2040 goal for our domestic aviation to be net zero. And we have a 2040 goal for our airports to be net zero. So this is the airports without the flights, mind you. This is just their own emissions from heating and lighting and the vehicles that drive around the airport. So it's a very sort of small proportion of aviation's total emissions, but that also has a 2040 net year. But it does have targets. It does have this trajectory. So you see the graph in the bottom left. You know, emissions of UK aviation in 2019 were just under 40 million tonnes. And this has a declining trajectory, which takes it down to about 19 million tonnes by 2050. And it is a gradually declining slope. And this was a real change. The original version of this showed emissions going up until 2030 and then peaking and then coming down again. And that's something that we fought really hard to change. If you watch the news tonight and you've seen the latest coverage from the COP meeting, some of the big issues now are not so much about the endpoint 2050, but how do we actually encourage states to move quickly and halve emissions by 2030? So that there has to be a near-term challenge. So we were pleased that this trajectory, and it's not the only trajectory you can draw, it probably wouldn't have been the trajectory we drew, but there is nevertheless a trajectory and you can monitor progress. So when you come to planning applications, you know, we can assess the state of the industry against a specific benchmark at a point of time and say, well, it's not even on track to sort of meet its climate commitments before we've even added more capacity. So we can develop those arguments, a helpful thing to have. It recognised that 2019 was a peak year for emissions. And that was also a really useful marker to set. I think, you know, as campaigning groups, either locally or nationally, if we ever see the industry go back above its 2019 peak, I think we've got strong grounds to press government to act quickly to tackle that. And I think the Department of Transport has said to us that it would expect NGOs and communities to hold them to account to that. So that's a good thing. And then the annual monitoring and 5-yearly reviews. So, you know, we can look at this trajectory, and if we're not performing quickly enough, then obviously it sends a strong signal to government. You need to really press those levers. And then finally, and I talked about this last year, so I won't spend a lot of time talking about it. The government does agree that there should be a proposal to give consumers better information at the point of sale. So not information that an airline gives you after you bought your ticket that says, oh, by the way, the emissions from this flight are X, would you like to buy an offset? But when you're looking to buy a ticket, it gives the consumers that information. And that way you can compare and contrast. And there's a huge difference sometimes, even between airlines. So it might make you stop and think, actually, I wasn't aware that, you know, a return trip to North America would be, you know, 3/4 of a ton of CO2 sitting in economy, even without the non-CO2 effects. I wasn't aware of that. Maybe I'll think again. But even if you are, you know, thinking about flying, it will allow you to pick an airline that is actually got a more efficient record and is doing more than another airline. And that information to consumers, I think, is long, long overdue. We have it for everything else, from food labelling to labelling the cars that we drive. And before you buy a car, you get the energy efficient. Why don't we have that for planes? So they're the good things, but they're about frameworks. They're not really about policies. So let's jump to the negatives. First of all, it's very light on policy. It's sort of set out its ambition, but it hasn't really developed the measures on how it's going to get there. It recognises those non-CO2 impacts, but hasn't actually put forward anything to immediately tackle them. If you look back at this graph on the bottom left, you will see that the line doesn't go to zero. All it really succeeds in doing is bringing aviation emissions down from 40 million tonnes down to about 19 million tonnes. So we've still got to work out how we deal with 19 million tonnes of aviation emissions. But more than anything else, it is so techno-optimistic. It thinks all of this can happen purely through greener fuels and, you know, technology changes that will allow us to fly cleaner. But it doesn't want to have a look at the big demand question. It doesn't want to look about when these improvements may happen, the chances of them happening, and to develop a narrative that actually says that we can't rely on this alone. We need to have a plan B. And I just want to sort of to expand on that a little bit in the sort of remaining minutes. So this is the government's scenario. This is how it intends to get down to 19 million tonnes. So the green bar is greener fuels. And I have to say, greener fuels are a little bit of a misnomer, really. When you put a biofuel, sorry, that shouldn't have gone backwards. When you put a biofuel on a plane or a synthetic fuel, when you burn it, it releases just as much CO2 as conventional kerosene. There's nothing greener about the actual fuel of when it's being burned. It's considered green because of how it was made. So rather than using fossil fuels, maybe you use something with a high biological component. So, you know, crops would be a good example in the US. You would grow crops, you would turn them into oil. And the CO2 that those plants captured means that they're considered to be greener than using fossil fuels, even though I say when they burn, they emit just as much CO2 into the atmosphere. But there's a big wedge from greener fuels. The wedge, the darker wedge above it that says 2 million tonnes, that's from zero carbon aircraft. So all the headlines that you've seen about electric flights and hydrogen planes, even the government doesn't expect this to make a big difference before 2050. And that's partly because we can't make batteries that are big enough. They make the planes too heavy. you know, there's lots of things around hydrogen that we still need to work out. So they'll actually say that there'll be a lot of hydrogen electric flights. I think 26% of all the flights in 2050 are estimated to be electric or hydrogen, but they're very small planes. They're operating very short routes, and therefore the overall emission savings is relatively modest compared to the other things. The light blue is fuel efficiency, and the top wedge, surprisingly, is labelled emissions trading systems and the UN's CORSIA offsetting scheme. But these aren't offsets. This is actually carbon pricing. So this is what airlines will have to pay to comply with these regulations. And because they have to pay, they put the price of tickets up. And because the ticket prices go up, demand goes down a little bit. And so all of those things work in tandem, but you're still left with the biggest wedge of all, which is this 19 million tons of residual emissions, of which the government's answer at the moment is we'll simply have to remove them elsewhere in the economy. So, you know, things like new technology that will literally suck carbon dioxide out of the air and convert it into either carbon bricks and we drop it down deep mine shafts, or we reuse it in some way in some sort of circular carbon economy. But it's relying on that sort of new technology to really deliver a huge scale. There isn't really a working carbon removal plant in the UK today. And yet in the next 30 years, we're apparently going to be saving ourselves 19 million tons a year. It's really hard to get our minds around the cost and the technological challenges that would rest on that. And as a result of that, we think these outcomes are quite risky. And it's not just us. This Element Energy slide, Element Energy is a consultancy, does a lot of work for government, for BEIS. The government even cited Element Energy in its Jet Zero strategy as the evidence source on various mitigation pathways. So we've spent a little bit of money this year with Element Energy. We said, seeing as you're a trusted government sort of source of information and analysis, what's your view on the likelihood of all these green fuels and technologies coming through? And this is what they came up with. They present us with a great report. This is a sort of summary chart. But the only one that they considered to the only policy element they considered to be low risk was including aviation in the UK's emissions trading system, which already happens, and that's why it's low risk. But everything else was a mid to high risk of not delivering. And if they don't deliver, a very high risk on the emission impact. And so, you know, we were disappointed that the government didn't take more heed of this report prior to setting out its final Jet Zero strategy, because I think for us it really highlights the risk. The other thing, and this looks like a lot of numbers, and it's badly labelled, but I think the other risk that the government has is greener fuels and new technologies are not cheap. So the best estimates, if you look at the column that's called SAF PTL, that's sustainable aviation fuels, power to liquids. But if you were to make that today, it would cost you about £852 per tonne of CO2 that you save. But it's forecast to decline. So by 2050, it may have dropped to about £304. The same on those carbon removals that I mentioned just now. You know, the price starts off high, but they fall with time. But in stark contrast, if you look at the CORSIA mid price, and I know that's jargon, but it's the cost of buying an offset, they're very low at the moment, typically about £3 in 2020, rising to about £6 in 2030. But the assumption the government makes is as carbon reductions become scarcer, this is going to escalate up to £378 per tonne by 2050. But those two things, if you look at them, go in different directions. So the cost of abating emissions is very high now and will fall, The cost of carbon is very low now, but will increase. But you really need a really high carbon price now to force the industry to adopt those greener technologies today, because if you just do it on a balance sheet basis, no one's going to make that investment. So if no one's making the early investment in all those wedges on this previous chart here, if no one's making the early investment here because they're too costly, it's very unlikely to see how they'll suddenly scale to the sort of volumes that we want to see in 2040 and 2050. So we think for those reasons, they're very risky. So does the Climate Change Committee in the UK. So this is the government's climate advisor set up by statute. And they also think it's risky. And because of that, they've criticised Jet Zero for having no recognition that demand needs to be managed. In fact, they've said the signs that have been sent by this government give completely the opposite message. So cutting air passenger duty for domestic flights, you know, the airport expansions that have gone through, they're all seen to be encouraging growth in the sector. Now, if you're a member of the public and you see these signals, it sounds like, you know, that climate is not an issue for aviation. You're being encouraged to do more and fly further. And so the Climate Change Committee said, you've given no recognition to the fact that demand needs to be managed. They were very specific that actually, because of that lack of ambition on demand, emissions are probably in 2030, 6.4 million tonnes higher than they should be. And I think, you know, the thing that you'll probably all appreciate and what it all comes down to is that the CCC explicitly said there should be no net expansion of UK airport capacity unless the industry is on track to outperform its net emissions trajectory. Now, they're nice words and we agree with them, but think of it this way. This proposal would say we need to reduce our emissions. If the industry goes faster than we expect, that's the moment to consider whether or not it's allowed to grow and have more capacity. Whereas the system that we have at the moment says we think it will all be all right in the 2040s and 2050s, and therefore it's okay to allow airports to expand today, but we're really gambling, and I don't see any way of rowing that back. If we find that the industry is not reducing emissions quick enough, how do you row back when those permissions have already been given? So my final slide really is just a shout out really to two organisations that have taken this Jet Zero to court or are in process of taking it to court. So the deadline for launching a judicial review of the Jet Zero strategy was the 19th of October. And in the couple of days preceding that deadline, two judicial review applications have gone through. Now, one of those is by our friends and fellow local campaign group, Galba. So this is the group for action on Leeds Bradford Airport. They've been fighting Leeds Bradford expansion for the last 2 or 3 years. And they are currently fundraising for their legal costs, but they've already put the application in. They're committed to doing this. They'll fund it one way or another. But please check out their website. And then on the NGO side, an organisation called Possible, you may know them as the inspiration behind the frequent flyer levy, but they have also issued a judicial review. Lee Day, the law firm, are working on both challenges. Estelle Dehan is leading the claim by Galba, and David Wolfe is leading the claim for Possible. I see Jenny, you're on the call. So Jenny Bates from Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth had a significant victory earlier this year, challenging the government's net zero strategy. So that's the strategy for the whole of the UK economy. And that same legal team is now working with Possible to say, well, actually, you know, Jet Zero is really a microcosm of net zero, and the same arguments apply here. So I think both organisations are quite confident that they have strong grounds to make the government rethink its progress. But certainly it would seem to us that the starting point for that would be to say, you know, yes, the industry will grow within the capacity it has today, but let's not compound this issue further with further increases until we know that we have the right mitigation and effective mitigation to bring this to an end. So I'm going to stop there, Sally. I don't know whether you want to open it to Q&A. I'll turn the screen sharing off and then we can see each other.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much, Tim. Just to say that CAGNY has actually donated to the Leeds Bradford Action, and Delighted Possible spoke last year at our first Time is Ticking event. I'm going to leave you in the hot seat because there's some questions that have come in. But I just wanted to ask you, did you see the FT article that aviation's calling for the government to invest in greener fuels this week? And it begs to ask the question, why should the taxpayer be paying for such a wealthy industry? I mean, do you have any views on that? Sorry, I can't hear you, Tim. I think you've muted yourself. Sorry.
I did mute myself. Sorry, Sally. Yeah, so I think we have strong views on this, actually. So you're right. There is this push at the moment. We were very frustrated with the Jet Zero strategy. I think industry is very frustrated with the Jet Zero strategy as well, because I think they wanted the Jet Zero strategy to set out all the ways in which government was going to help them get to net zero. And it hasn't really done that yet. I mean, although it has all those pretty graphs about how you may do it, it's very much being thrown back to the industry. And this is the industry coming back and saying, but all this is really expensive. And because of COVID and the lack of passenger numbers, we don't have a lot of cash. And we really want you to help us to make that transition. Now, I think certainly from AEF's point of view, although some NGOs wouldn't even be as generous as AEF, from AEF's point of view, if we're talking about some seed money to invest in the infrastructure to produce greener fuels, or the infrastructure to sort of investigate further how we remove carbon from the atmosphere, I think that's one thing. I think a degree of government investment to encourage private sectors investors to come into that space may be helpful. But I say not all NGOs would even agree with that. But I think the idea that the taxpayer will pay for the differential between greener planes and greener fuels and using kerosene, that is an absolute red line for us. That it's the passenger that has to pay. I mean, these proposals have to be fully costed. They have to be added to ticket prices, and it's the consumer that ultimately has to meet the costs of decarbonising this sector.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we would totally agree with you on that one. Mm. Okay, so Alexandra has asked, are the flights from France to Spain international or domestic?
So they are actually from the UK to France and the UK to Spain. They are regarded as international.
Okay.
There is a surprising statistic that shows that more people fly internationally on a UK passport than any other nation, more than the Chinese, more than the Americans. We take more international flights, but that's partly because there's a small island. Almost every flight, whichever way you go, is an international flight. Whereas that chart I showed at the beginning, large numbers of flights in America and China are obviously domestic and internal. So it's not to say that people in the UK fly the most, but we fly internationally the most. Mm-hmm. But yes, though the flights from the UK to France and the UK to Spain are recognised as international flights.
So France to Spain would be a domestic flight because it's inside Europe?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's still regarded as international for the purposes of country total. So Spain will be reporting to ICAO and France will be reporting to ICAO, so they'll all report those as international flights. Obviously, the EU has an ability to tackle those intra-EU flights. If we want to tackle international flights, I think you can do it today. The rest of the world doesn't necessarily agree, and they say, well, you should talk to us and we ought to reach some sort of bilateral agreement. But, you know, you remove all that international politics in the EU, because by definition, if the bloc has agreed, you could do those international flights and treat them as if they were, in effect, domestic flights for the EU region.
I'm delighted you mentioned that the action over net zero is going through Lead Day, because that's our legal support for Gatwick going for a second runway next year. So they're going to have obviously lots of experience at battling the government on this jet zero. So we've got one from Aidan. There was a long article in this week's Sunday Telegraph business section, Project Napkin. This is a plan to achieve guilt-free flying using a fleet of hydrogen aircraft. These would be short-haul flights, and the target date is 2035. Do you think this is achievable, and would it make a difference? I know that EasyJet stopped offsetting, and they are looking at hydrogen. What do you think?
Yeah, so we're not against electric and hydrogen. In fact, we also have, as AEF, a project with Cambridge University and McKinsey are doing the sort of number crunching for us. But, you know, we want zero emission aircraft. So this is where the messaging sometimes gets confused. We're not against the technology. We would add a caveat that says you shouldn't just be aiming at zero carbon emissions. You should be looking at zero climate impact. And hydrogen aircraft will still have non-CO2 impacts. Electric flights will not. But with that caveat that you look at it on a climate basis, yes, we should be investigating these things. To some extent, they already exist. So ZeroAvia has a hydrogen fuel cell plane. There are electric planes. They operate. They're safe. They demonstrate that the technology works. But they're only available over very short distances, and they only take about 4 to 6 passengers. Mm-hmm. So it's this scaling up. So this is the real challenge. And this is why, you know, when you start getting labels like guilt-free flying, it's you tell people that it's okay today. You don't need to think about it. When actually, although we've identified the technology, the scaling up is such a big technological challenge. We can't have confidence, as much as we may want to support it and make it happen. We can't have confidence. Mm-hmm. I said earlier that the government doesn't have a lot of emission reductions planned because of hydrogen and electric. And that's because it will still be on these very, very, very short routes. So I think the second part of the question was, if it happens by 2035, I think probably if you're talking about a 30-seater aircraft, that may be realistic. If you're talking about a 100-seater aircraft, that probably looks closer to 2045 or 2050. But would it make a difference in emissions? Probably not a great deal on those small routes, not in terms of the overall challenge, although we could operate whole parts of the UK zero emissions. So Highlands and Islands of Scotland, for example, maybe some short domestic flights, we could see those operating. But compared to the long haul routes and the emissions from that, it's not going to make a big dent in our overall emission profile. And I think the DfT work agrees. Actually, it's not an issue of disagreement with government. They don't see a big emission reduction coming from these new methods of propulsion.
Gosh, right, okay. How is net zero even theoretically possible in aviation by any date? I think that's probably what you've answered.
Well, I think it's that graph, isn't it? It's the fact that actually it doesn't go to zero. The best the government can hope for is getting it from about 38, 39 million tonnes down to 19. But that is assuming that we allow passenger numbers to increase by 70%. Mm. If we only allow passenger numbers to increase by, say, 25%, then actually we would make deeper reductions. And the 2050 emissions wouldn't be 19 million tonnes. They'd probably be somewhere around more like 12. Mm. And so, you know, it's part of the problem is we're still creating this problem because we're locked into this growth cycle. But the question is right. It doesn't really matter whether it's 12 million tons or 19 million tons. It's still not zero. And that's the point. We can't get this sector down to zero. And that's where the word net comes in. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's going to be wholly reliant on carbon removals or reductions in elsewhere in the economy to offset it.
Yeah, I mean, Ian Gibson makes a very good point. Is where's the infrastructure to store this hydrogen? It's a point that Cadney's made with Gatwick. There's with all their plans for a second runway, they're making no facilities for these new fuel sources.
Yeah.
So it's at the moment, SAF, the sustainable aviation fuel, for the small amount they use in some flights, it's having to be transported in. So I suppose the same argument is that how do you produce the electricity to fly a plane when we're talking about having blackout periods? Anyway, I'm going to bring a lady in here.
Can I just say, very briefly, Sally, on that. It's really good question to highlight the infrastructure side.
Mm.
Because, you know, we're talking about the aircraft technology, but even if we've got the aircraft technology, you can't just plug an electric plane into the national grid. It would turn the lights off in Crawley. You know, you're really going to have to think about micro generation facilities within airports. You know, Rolls Royce are thinking of these small nuclear reactor generators. They're sort of small scale reactors that could power cities and towns on their own. But you know, you may need something like that. Or you know, where are the fuel tanks for the hydrogen? If you're gonna you can combust hydrogen, how are you going to store it? So these are big issues, and it makes you think: what does the airport of the future look like? I mean, you know, these airports are planning to expand on a conventional two runways and a terminal here, but where will the planes physically park, and how will we develop the infrastructure? That's part of the challenge.
Okay, so Armel.
Yes, thank you. Yes,
thank you. I'm going to have to, we've got really limited time and there's quite a few more questions. So can you be really precise?
Well, I was going to mention demand management, but that's already been said. As the widow of a founder member of BEA in 1946 and British Airways now, no internal flight and no European flight makes any money. So you will have noticed that when any flights are cancelled, it is never, unless absolutely necessary, they never actually cancel the internal flights or the external flights or the European flights. So those, I think it's immoral and dishonest, because what they are trying to do is said you can fly as much as you like and you can offset what you do. It doesn't actually cut down on the CO2 emission, which is what we need to do. Now, what I wanted to say to a team, and it's nice to see you, I last saw you on Saturday, so it's nice to see you twice in 4 days. In 2020 or 21, under the Boris Johnson government, I think it was actually at COP26, companies, businesses were told that they had to give to the department bees probably every year, the number of CO2 emission that they had cut down to actually be part of their net zero. So I was just wondering if the AEF is actually sort of keeping an eye on that and whether businesses are actually cutting down on their flights, because, you know, at Heathrow, for instance, it's the business situation which is actually helping Heathrow to make money. So what is the AEF thinking of that? Are the businesses actually cutting down on their CO2 as part of their net zero? Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Lamel. It's a good, really good question. So there's a campaign called Travel Smart. It's European wide. It looks at the top 100 businesses in Europe to start with. It's all of them have had letters. So it's not just AEF, but a group of NGOs working collaboratively, challenging them, what are you doing? And the big ones are, I mean, you've probably seen Ernst & Young trying to slash their sort of business travel by about 50%. You know, it saves them money, it saves their staff time. And they haven't lost any sort of business and customers as a result. So that will have a dramatic impact, because as you probably know, passengers sitting at the front of the plane, which generally on business fares, contribute about 65% of airline revenues. So that demand drops, they have to make up their revenue from the back of the plane, and airfares rise. And that, you could see a real shift in airline business models as a result.
There's a number of questions about offsetting, because offsetting obviously applies to Gatwick and Heathrow passengers, but not for the smaller airports such as Biggin Hill. Is there a plan to force them to comply to the net zero? What percentage do we know of passengers offset their flights today? I would imagine that's pretty low. Yes. And there are other higher priorities for greenhouse gas removals that are possibly large, you know, like gas heating for homes. So I think, yeah, I agree with, I would personally agree with that one. But, you know, offsetting, what we've seen EasyJet move away from it. What we've always said it's marketing fiction, but what's AEF's view or your view, Tim?
Well, I think it shows you that it's a bit of a win, isn't it, really, that over the last 4 or 5 years, and, you know, it's not just aviation that offsets, but I think offsetting has become not only confused, but quite a murky world. And the public recognise that. They're not sure, they're not convinced by its effectiveness. And I think as a result of that, you know, EasyJet, as you said, have been needing to turn their backs on it. Our view is that there's a, you know, you can have, most offsets are avoided emissions. Mm. You know, so you don't chop down a forest, and as a result of that, you can set a credit to say that you saved some CO2. That's an avoided emission. It doesn't actually reduce emissions in the air. Carbon removals, if that technology begins to exist, if we can actually remove carbon from the air, then that is potentially a different form of offsetting. And I think, you know, the Climate Change Committee has said, you know, if we're going to use international offsets, they should be in the form of removals. But that's where governments need to think about focusing their efforts, not focusing their efforts on sort of avoided emissions, which are, don't really do anything, don't add anything. We don't think that they do very much at all. The percentage of passengers that offset, less than 1%. In fact, I think it's significantly less than 1%. Airlines don't regularly publish, but I do know it's less than 1%. So it's a very small, and I would imagine diminishing proportion. It's not the answer. It's got to be proper decarbonisation of the sector.
Okay, so we are half past. Been in the hot seat a long time. Thank you so much. I'm just gonna, you know. As you were, just give a quick bash for Cagney here. We have got our coffee, you know, donate your cost of your coffee every day to help us oppose the second runway. It may seem novel, but for the whole of COP, you know, 27, that donation of your coffee, which, I mean, averages out £3.10 a day, just helps Cagney carry on. So that's part of our commitment. Our time is ticking. And I have to say a huge thank you to Tim. We really appreciate your support throughout the year, and we really support you coming along as part of our Time is Ticking. The session we have on Thursday is someone a lot of us will know, is John Stewart. He's coming along with the UK Noise Association, and he's obviously going to be talking about noise. It's going to be a conversation piece with our very own Lisa Morris, who is very impacted by aircraft noise. So lots of chats come in. Thank you so much for an excellent talk, Tim. And I'm going to sign off there. If anyone wants to catch up, this will be on the Cagney YouTube channel from tomorrow. And it will also be on our podcast, so you can just listen to it whilst you're doing whatever you're doing, as long as it's not getting on a plane, I guess. But anyway, so thank you, also Tim. Thank you, everyone, for attending, and hope to see lots of you on Thursday. Thank you and goodbye.